Hello, I'm Nicole Swanson, and welcome to Forza Tutti, the podcast by Zircon Arts, where we explore the power of creativity and collaboration at the intersection of the arts, education, public policy, and social justice. The episode you're about to hear was part of a series entitled The Intentional Effective Music Teacher. It was recorded in the spring of 2020, near the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic. I would love to hear your thoughts on this conversation. Send me an email at nicole@zirconarts.com. And now, on with the show.
Hey, welcome back to The Intentionally Effective Music Teacher. Today, our guest is Brian Balmages, who has had quite a multifaceted career that you will hear all about.
I was listening to an interview that you had given, and you were talking about one of your former teachers and how he was a key for you that unlocked all kinds of things inside you. Can you tell us a little bit about that particular teacher, or, you know, other teachers that have really been influential in your life along the way?
Sure. I believe that specific person that you're talking about is Gary Green, who was the director of bands at the University of Miami in Florida. I always say in Florida because I always joke around that's the real University of Miami.
Right.
Not the one anyway.
In Ohio.
So, yeah, we don't want to – yeah. So, you know, when I got to Miami, I always talk about how I was a very good trumpet player. I was a concerto competition winner, and I was just starting to play professionally and doing all that kind of stuff. The one thing that I always – I should say I don't felt because I really didn't know it was lacking until I was made aware of it. But the one thing that was always lacking in my playing was this true musicality, this idea of true musicianship, not just playing something loud because it's Mark's forte, but playing it a certain type of loud because you understand the context that the music was written in. You understand what's going on around your particular line. You understand programmatically or emotionally what the composer was going through or was identifying with historically during that time. And all those things contribute to the way you play that forte, which is why all of us that have played professionally know that there are a million different fortes, and it just depends on the piece you're playing. And so when I got to Miami, I was a great technical player. I had a great sound and I had great technique, but I just wasn't really truly achieving my voice with it. And he's one of those people that really unlocked that in me and made me start to not just enjoy playing music, but start to feel the music that I was playing. And I know that sometimes sounds a little corny, but I mean it in a very serious way that I finally started to realize, wow, there's a reason that I want to lean into this phrase, and not just because there's a crescendo written, but because the phrase is just, it's begging to land at that moment. And so that was a very big learning curve for me, probably one of the biggest learning curves that I had. And once I started to venture into that world, obviously it's one of those things that once you start to experience that, you can't experience it any other way.
Right. What was that process like? I mean, how did that get unlocked? Was it through conversations with him, or did he play things in a different way, or was he asking you questions, or what was that process like?
A lot of it just happened to be these long conversations that I would just have with him in his office, and we would just talk about music, and it wasn't even part of a course. We would just talk about things. He also brought in a lot of composers and I got the chance to do the orchestral and the band thing. So I always say I played professionally. I was an orchestral trumpet player, but Gary was our band director. And so a lot of my composer experiences at that point were with band composers. And so he brought in people like David Maslanka, and we played the music of Michael Colgrass and got a chance to work under him. These really phenomenal composers who were there firsthand kind of describing things to us and not always saying this needs to be louder, this needs to be shorter, but explaining the why of things, right? Yeah. And so that was part of it, these big, long conversations that we would have in his office, sometimes just kind of at random, where I'd go in there and ask him a question, and then 45 minutes later, we had gone off on a completely new topic, but he had really opened up some things for me. And then the other part of it was really being in rehearsal under him and seeing not only how he rehearsed us, but how he reacted to the music that he was conducting. And I think that was a really big thing for me, just watching him respond to the sound. And when something wasn't right, you know, he was never one to stop and say, guys, that's not in tune, or that's too short, or that's too loud. It was always, there was always a musical reason.
Okay.
It just didn't feel right to him. And so the combination of, I think, all those things really, really kind of unlocked that.
Interesting. How does that inform your creative process today as a composer? Like when you're writing, I've noticed that a lot of your music is, you know, programmatic or thematic, or, you know, there's definitely some sort of imagery that it evokes. And I assume that's intentional.
Sure.
Is that correct?
Well, everything that I write is absolutely meant to evoke something. All right.
Right.
Sometimes it is programmatic in nature. Clearly, yeah, there's plenty of pieces that I wrote that have a great programmatic element to them. I tend to really explore that more with pieces for younger players, only because I think it's easier for a young player to latch on to a programmatic concept, and that by default will make them more musical if they can understand what they're playing. When I get into upper level music and sometimes even middle level music, at that point, then it can be inspired by anything. And sometimes it just draws from a word or from a phrase or a concept. I just premiered, there's a virtual orchestra that we just released. Ironically, we started this a year ago with no idea that we would be releasing this during this pandemic.
Sure.
And so this is a year-long process, but the piece was called Greater Than. And the whole piece was based on this idea of individuals from all over the country performing together in this virtual orchestra, how the orchestra, and any orchestra, live or virtual, is so much more powerful when you look at the whole versus the sum of its parts.
Yep.
And so that's a piece that was inspired kind of just by a phrase. There's no programmatic intent there, but clearly there are a lot of elements that you can draw on for inspiration, for emotional stimulation, all those kinds of things.
Do you ever, in your scores, do you write a couple of words or phrases to kind of help the inspiration along? Or I imagine it's interesting as a composer to just kind of throw your work out there into the ether and then not really know what people are going to do with it. How much do you try to control that? And maybe that's a silly way of wording it, but you know how.
Well, it's not.
Okay.
It's not a silly thing at all. So you will not be shocked, nor will anybody that listens to this be shocked to know that there are pieces out there that I have released over the years where I have heard stunning performances beyond anything that I even imagined, just absolutely amazing. And then there have also been performances that have been so stunningly off from anything I could have imagined. And it's interesting because sometimes these performances, they're lacking in the most basic of elements. And you say, how much do you put in there? Sometimes they're just not even close to the mark tempo. Or I'll have a ritardando. One of the things that I always joke around about, but it's not really funny at all, is this idea of groups that at the end of phrases, when I have marked like a ritardando or a little con moto or something like that, and especially in a school group when a conductor is always worried about keeping the group together. So you'll see a lot of times they ignore those markings and those ends of the phrases are just, they're over.
Right.
And there's no sensitivity there. There's no idea of moving into silence or moving out of silence or moving to a point of rest. It's just kind of done. Mm-hmm. And so what happens is the group stays together, which is great for the group. And the only thing that happens as a consequence is you destroy the musical intent.
Right.
But the group stays together. So at least that's good.
Right.
And so I always, and so I always make that comment. I said, you know, yes, I'd like to put in a lot of, I try to put in as much as I think a director will need, at least a director with what I would think of as a decent amount of musical intuition.
Sure.
But at the same time, beyond that, sometimes I'm just looking for a director who is, number one, just observing the basic things that I have marked there.
Right.
And then beyond that, then I'm looking for the director who's willing to take a risk, who's willing to say, hey, this music is really exciting and we've really got to be on the edge.
Yeah.
Right? Or this music is really dramatic and really mournful and it's marked at quarter equals 50. And so maybe we shouldn't go at quarter equals 70 just because it'll help with the phrasing.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we need to really slow it down and experience this music a bit more deliberate, a little bit slower, a little bit more methodical. And if the ensemble can't do that, then maybe this is not the right piece for that ensemble.
Right. And it's so interesting to hear you say all of this because I'm just reminded of so many rehearsals that I've been in as a musician and then also as a coach in schools where it's like so many of the reminders from the director are just things that are already in the music, you know, and it's like if we could just play what's in the music, all of us, and just start there and then make the extra music on top of that. But yeah, I feel like we spend so much time in rehearsal just like reminding ourselves what the composer actually already put in there. And it's like, no, he actually probably did really mean that.
Right. And then I think the other interesting thing that people sometimes need to be reminded of is, and certainly you know this from your professional orchestral experience, and I've enjoyed being an orchestral trumpet player as well, but people need to be reminded of the fact that we, in these professional orchestral situations, you show up on Monday and every player in the orchestra has their music down. Or like I went and worked with the United States Army Band in February. And the first rehearsal, everybody has everything down.
Yeah.
And the ritardandos are there and the accelerandos are there. And then you spend a week or 3 or 4 days rehearsing the music when everything's already down.
Mm-hmm.
You're not tuning chords.
Right.
And so there's all that rehearsal that's done. And I think sometimes it's important to realize that's why we rehearse.
Right.
Like that's the end goal. That's the end goal is why we try to rehearse and not to get everything in tune and together. That of course is important, but that once you've got all that achieved, great. You're now ready to start rehearsal.
Right. So then when it comes to, you know, beginner students or intermediate students in a middle school or a high school setting where perhaps it's not quite so easy to do that. I think if part of that goes back to what you were just saying, that maybe repertoire choice is a huge component where ideally you want to choose a piece that you can make music out of and not where you have to just focus so much on reminding people what the composer wrote in the music.
I think there's two things, and I think that's one of them. But I think the other thing, if I may, I think the other thing is not only getting to that point, but also understanding that kids need to feel more of a sense of self-empowerment and more responsibility. I think in my travels, at least, I find that a lot of places I go, whether it's an honor orchestra, an honor band, or school band, or an all-state, whatever it might be, that there is this general notion that kids will learn the part during rehearsal. Like, I'll get it down. And I would love to see directors kind of expect their kids more to say, no, we're not going to learn it during rehearsal. We're going to learn it. You learn it on your own.
Yeah.
And then when you come in, then we'll have this to do together, and we'll make music together. But I think I would love to see more of that. And to be honest, in this quarantine world that we're in right now, it's a great opportunity to get kids to do that. But the difficulty is to motivate them to do it, right? When there's not those check-ins. So that's the tricky part.
Right. But just to raise the expectations a little bit more. So that's
absolutely.
Yeah.
We all know that in general, kids will rise to whatever expectation we set for them. And if we set the expectation that you're going to get really good at learning your part in rehearsal, they will meet it every time.
Mm-hmm. When you're writing music for students, how do you go about writing music for a certain skill level? And do you find that hampers your creative process? Or, I mean, obviously you've been doing this for several years now. Has it become kind of second nature to write something for grade 2 versus grade 5?
Absolutely. It's the same. It's the same. And I mean that without hesitation at all. That's one of the big questions people always ask is, you know, how do you write or how do you negotiate all the limitations that go into grade 1 and 2 music, then turn around and do grade 5 music? And the answer is quite simple. In my mind, no group has any limitations, and I'll explain that. But all these people will say, oh, well, when you're writing for a grade 2 orchestra, there are so many limitations with that, right? Maybe they can't play in third position yet, and maybe the cellist can't do extensions yet, and, oh, the high threes, they might be able to play them, but, boy, they're going to be out of tune, and don't play in flats, and don't do this, and there's all these limitations. And the funny thing is that if I were to say to somebody, well, writing a piece for a professional string quartet, are there any limitations there? And the typical answer will be like, well, no, they're professionals. They can play anything. And my response would be, well, what if I hear a bass part? Well, that's not in that ensemble. Oh, okay. What if I hear this great big percussion groove going on? Well, that's not in a string quartet. When I write for a professional brass quintet, it's like, well, I hear 7 pitches in this chord, but I only have 5 players. Right? And talking about all the color changes. Now I hear the soaring strings with the harmonics. Well, they're not in a brass quintet. And so when you think about all these things, right, technically every group has limitations.
Right.
But nobody says it. Nobody says it. A professional string quartet, hey, we can play anything that's written for us, right? We're the best of the best, and we can play everything. And so nobody thinks of it that way. And so I apply that exact same concept to a middle school group.
Yeah.
And so my answer would be, hey, listen, this is a grade 2 middle school orchestra. They can play anything that any other grade 2 middle school orchestra can play. And I always tell teachers to say that. If they're commissioning somebody and somebody says, all right, well, tell me about the limitations of your group. Say, oh, we have no limitations. We're grade 2. We can play anything any other grade 2 ensemble can play. Right? And so what it becomes is a question of available colors and the palette that you have available. So maybe instead of writing with 64 different colors, maybe I'm drawing with 16 colors.
Yep.
Or maybe I'm drawing with 4 colors. Or maybe I'm doing a grade half and all I'm doing is a grayscale shading.
Yep.
I think we would all agree that there's some pretty fabulous artwork that has been done in grayscale with pencil.
Totally. And it's so interesting that you brought that color thing into it, because as you were talking, I was imagining in my head these different artist palettes, literally, with the different, you know, different colors on them. And okay, so here's the palette for this level, and here's the palette for a string quartet, and here's the palette that you use for a brass ensemble. And that makes so much sense, that the quality of the art doesn't have to be limited by what's
right
on the palette.
And so what you wind up doing is not saying, wow, I really hear this big idea, but I'm going to squeeze it down to fit this little circle of limitations, but rather, these are the tools that I have to work with for this group. What can I do with these tools? How much can I create with the tools that I'm given?
I love that. I think that's an idea that's applicable in general too, you know, not just in terms of composition, but just, you know, not seeing, it's a mindset thing, not seeing things as limiting, but just, okay, working with the tools that we have and creating what we can with the tools that are available.
Boy, how's that applicable for today's situation,
yeah,
huh?
Seriously.
There it is in a nutshell.
Yep. Use what you've got and make the best of it. Can you tell us a little bit more about your creative process? How many pieces do you write at a time? Do you have like multiple works going on at a time, or are you like a start to finish one at a time? Are you constantly composing? Do you take breaks from composing sometimes? How does that work?
Yeah, I'm usually working on somewhere between 20 to 30 pieces at once.
Wow.
I'm totally kidding. That's so bogus. I would go nuts.
Okay. Not at all.
Typically, I am a one. I like my relationships to be one-on-one, and so typically, I am having a relationship with one piece at a time.
Okay.
I do not write multiple pieces at a time. There are times where I might get stuck or locked, and I can't figure my way through a piece that I'm working on. And if time allows, sometimes I will put that piece down and turn to another piece that I'm really inspired by at that moment
mm-hmm.
and complete that piece. But I don't go back and forth between pieces.
Okay.
It's not something that I'm able to do successfully. And I know other people that do it, and that's fine. For me, I can't do it because, among other things, I get lost in the form if I'm going back and forth between pieces. And maybe I'm working on one piece and then I flip back to another piece. Well, it's hard to understand, even though you've written it, it's hard to comprehend the emotional journey that you've taken up until the point where you are.
Right.
And then just pick right up where you left off and keep going. And then put that down and then figure out where you were again. And so what I find is when I used to try to do this, where I would kind of work on multiple projects or go back and forth, I would wind up with music that sounded very disjunct or very distracted, very incoherent. And so I would have to then kind of go back and say, all right, I'm going to just focus on this one idea and create more linear thought process from one section to the other. So it didn't feel like, you know, I would get lost. Because sometimes when you're thinking about it, even in the concept of orchestration, you might spend 2 hours orchestrating something, and then you say, "Oh, I'm ready to go into a completely new section right now. Let's go." And then it's not until you look back at what you've done and realize I spent 2 hours orchestrating 20 seconds of music.
Yeah.
And in your mind, it's like, "Hey, we just spent 2 hours on that. We're ready to move on to another idea." And the reality is you're not at all ready to move on to another idea. And so that's why I don't go back and forth between pieces.
Yeah.
To answer your question about how do I write, you know, I typically write one of three ways. I used to try to write every piece the same way. And then I realized one day, it just kind of hit me in the face that I realized, you know what? When I used to play trumpet, every day I'd pick up my horn and I would feel different.
Hmm.
Right, and I think that's very similar for almost any instrumentalist. There were days that I would pick up my horn where I would play like five notes, and I just realized today's going to be a fabulous day. Whatever I play today, I'm going to be amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And then there were days where I'd pick it up and I'd say, hey, it's going to be a fine day. And then there were other days that I picked it up and I would ask myself, do I even play this instrument? Right.
Right. Yep.
Do we even know each other? And, you know, it's like golf. You just kind of swing and nothing happens. You miss. And obviously, the more you play, the more you realize that depending on those first few moments that you are with your instrument, you vary your warm-up. And some days your warm-up might be a couple minutes. Some days you might spend an hour warming up and then have to step away from the instrument for an hour before you feel that bond again. And for me, composing is very similar. Sometimes I start trying to write one way and it doesn't feel good at all. And rather than just hammer it, I say, well, this piece doesn't want to be written this way right now, so we'll change. And so sometimes I will just sit at the computer and write directly into Finale. And people always say, what's the best notation program to use? My answer is always, it's the one you know how to use.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll get that out of there right now. And I know how to use Finale, and that's what I like. So sometimes if an idea is really speaking to me, I might just start orchestrating within Finale, or I might just kind of sketch melodic ideas, just little sections into the computer and do it that way. Other mm-hmm. times I will sit at the piano. There have been pieces that I've written that did not want to be written at all at the computer. And yeah. so I might sit at the piano and play for a while and figure that out. And then there have been other times that it didn't want to be written at the piano either. And I just need to sit down at the dining room table with a piece of manuscript paper and a pencil. And that's mm-hmm. it. And mm-hmm. just write. And that still is my favorite way to write. I think it's the most intimate, the most organic, and the most natural way. Because
you notice,
touch what you're working on.
Yeah. Do you notice a difference in what comes out, like in the end product, based on what
absolutely.
Method you
I
used?
I think a couple things. I think I tend to be the most creative when I'm writing by hand.
Okay.
Because you're not tethered to what you can technically play on a piano.
Mm-hmm.
Nor are you tethered to the notation
right.
limitations of whatever you're working on. And not to say that every program has notation limitations. I mean, there are plenty of ways to do it. But I think very often when you're notating into a computer and you run into a brick wall on something and it's going to take a while, you just say,
yeah.
oh, well, I'll just do it this other way and you know, not worry about it. And with pencil and paper, you can write anything you want to in seconds.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And it doesn't matter. And so I find that some of my most creative ideas do come out when I'm writing by hand.
Okay. That makes sense. Talk, if you will, a little bit about inspiration from other composers. I know I've heard you talk, and I've read things that you've written about drawing inspiration from everywhere, not just classical music, mm-hmm. but other areas as well. Can you share a little bit about what composers and what styles of music have inspired and influenced you?
Sure. I mean, I've certainly been influenced by a ton of them. Probably some of my earliest influences, which were dating back to middle school and high school, were, and I think a lot of us go through this, was film music. I think really getting into the Pops recordings of the Cincinnati Pops and the Boston Pops and some of that really was some of my earliest positive experiences with orchestral music. And of course, I could highlight somebody that everybody in the world tends to highlight, and that's John Williams.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it was a double whammy for me because I was interested in composition, but I was also a trumpet player. And so, you know, you foam at the mouth for that stuff. And even though it hurts when you're playing it, but it's still fun to play. And so for me, that was one of my earliest experiences with a composer that I remember really being inspired by.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing about him that really inspired me as I became more aware of my relationship with music and composition and performance and conducting, one of the things that I really loved about John Williams was that his music was not only extraordinary in a film setting, but that he was able to take a melodic idea and develop it much like it would be in a symphony, right?
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of his music really does work almost like a symphony if you take it out of the music. I love the fact that his music works so well on stage, and I love the fact that he writes music for stage, and
mm-hmm.
I love the fact that he was also a conductor on top of all that. And so those things kind of became something for me to emulate. I wanted to be a composer who was also a conductor, and I wanted to be able to write in a cinematic style, not always, but I wanted to be able to do those types
mm-hmm.
of things. And so that was a big inspiration for me. And then I think as I got into this more, I started to get inspired by some of the amazing composers that I think probably have inspired John Williams and countless other folks, composers like Stravinsky, composers
yeah.
like Mahler, and Ravel, especially with the orchestration of Ravel.
Yep.
And then, you know, for me, more modern day composers like Mason Bates and the way he's been able to create and carve out his own voice. And then I look to pop groups,
mm-hmm.
and I look at the groups that have been able to kind of carve out their own style and their own genre. And so I grew up listening to a lot of classic rock music, and that led me into all kinds of things like metal and R&B and just you name it. And I was,
yeah.
I was there. And I tried writing a lot of those styles. You know, for my master's project, one of the things that I wrote was a heavy metal tune, like psychedelic heavy metal. And my professor even said he was a little worried about me after it was all over. But at the same time, I learned so much, right?
Right.
And it was fun. And so there have been orchestra pieces that I have written. One of them is called Lyric Metal that was inspired by heavy metal, but it was all written for orchestra. It was kind of like in that style of Apocalyptica, the Finnish cello quartet that does all that heavy metal stuff.
And if we go back to the idea of, you know, the artist's palette, basically by having those other styles in your brain and at your disposal, that enhances the colors on that palette that you have to work with.
Yeah, people, as I've asked me, they say, well, when we got, because it's very important to note that I do not have a composition degree, and I never studied composition formally. And I don't have a performance degree, and I don't have an education degree, and I don't have a conducting degree. So it's kind
and
of
yet
like,
you've done
oh,
all
right,
of those things.
Well, I studied them all.
Right.
But I don't have any formal training. I was a music industry major in my undergraduate, and one of the reasons why was because I was writing music already, but I wanted to learn how to record the music that I was writing so I could create demo CDs and stuff to share with people. And so that happened. Now, the orchestral trumpet stuff, clearly I was very serious as a trumpet player. I didn't feel I needed to have a performance degree to be serious as a trumpet player. And so I made a vow that I was going to be a music industry major, and then I would just practice more than all the performance majors. And funny thing is, every time I took an orchestral audition, nobody said to me, well, wait, do you have a performance degree before you play?
Right.
Nobody ever asked me that.
Right.
And so there was that. And then I went to my master's degree, and I got a degree in media writing and production. And that taught me how to write for various types of media. I was writing commercials for radio. I was doing film scoring stuff. I was doing I was writing for rhythm section and combo, and I was writing for jazz ensemble. And all these different things, and that really just broadened the color palette that I had
mm-hmm.
to draw from.
Yep.
And so those are all things that I did. And obviously, yes, I did a lot of conducting, and I studied conducting. I think credit requirement for most undergraduate degrees is about, 120 credits, I think?
Sounds right,
And my undergraduate degree, I graduated with 204 credits.
Oh, my gosh. But that's given you this multifaceted perspective and this multifaceted career that you've enjoyed so far. Where do you see yourself in 10 years?
I think, first of all, I obviously want to still be very relevant as a composer and a conductor. There's no question about that.
Yeah.
I do see myself doing this. I would love nothing more than for the 10-year version of me from now to look back and to really appreciate the music that I am writing right now and to enjoy the music that I'm writing right now, but at the same time realize, you know, that's fine, but geez, I don't write anything like that anymore. Like I've evolved so much since then. And that's the way the current version of me looks at 10 years ago from now too.
Yeah.
I look at some of the music that I wrote 10 years ago and some of it I still conduct. A lot of it I don't. And it doesn't mean anything about the quality of it. It's just that I've evolved.
Right.
And the way I think has become more complex, especially my relationship with music and emotion has become much more complex. And I think I find much more of that in my music now than I did 10 years ago. And so I'm hoping that 10 years from now, I am able to continue to experience that. And I think I'm hopeful that 10 years from now, I am able to make a further impact in the world. It's just recently that I've truly embraced the idea that music can highlight social issues.
Yeah.
And that music can help bring about social justice. And that music can help bring beauty into a world that is so damaged and at times very ugly. And so these are things that I'm now just starting to appreciate, and sometimes even discover to an extent. And so I'm eager to see what I'm able to do 10 years from now when the appreciation and understanding of all that really has sunk in, and I start to understand how to take some of those emotions, some of those concepts, some of those issues, and truly explore them.
Sounds like it's going to be a great decade ahead for you. Well, if our audience wants to learn more about you, more about your music, where should they go?
They can find me on the web. The good news is I'm the only Brian Balmagus in the world.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
So if you find
All right.
Brian Balmagus, it's me. Yep. And and my web address is just brianbalmagus.com.
All right. So brianbalmagus.com. There's only one of them. I would also encourage you to do a little bit of digging into the February concert that he mentioned with the U.S. Army Band. There's a pretty phenomenal story surrounding one of the pieces that was written for that concert. So I'm just going to leave this here as a little nugget for you to go and explore a little bit more. I hope you enjoyed getting to know Brian and hearing more about his work, and I look forward to our next session. I'll talk to you then.